Today is Monday, January 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Our top stories today, a new report from Oxfam says the world's billionaires own more wealth than 60% of the planet's population.
The problem of super rich and the problem of the billionaires is a relatively new one. We've seen the number of billionaires double in the last 10 years. We've seen their wealth higher than it's ever been before.
And coming up, cases of a mysterious new coronavirus from China have tripled. Also ahead, today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the United States, when Americans remember the legacy of the famed civil rights leader. An outbreak of a new coronavirus that began in the Chinese city Wuhan has spread to the capital Beijing and Shanghai, national and local authorities confirmed Monday. Meanwhile, South Korea confirmed its first case, a 35-year-old Chinese national who had traveled from Wuhan. Two cases have also been reported in Thailand and one in Japan. All involved people from Wuhan or who had recently visited the city. There are now at least 220 confirmed cases worldwide and three deaths. Authorities around the globe, including in the United States and many Asian countries, have stepped up screening of travelers from Wuhan. It is not yet clear how the virus spreads. It is in the same family as the virus that caused severe acute respiratory syndrome, also called SARS, a deadly disease that killed more than 800 people, most of them in Hong Kong and southern China, in 2003. To learn more about the outbreak, earlier today I spoke with World Health Organization spokesman Tariq Jasarevich in Geneva, Switzerland.
Well, we have seen the increasing number of confirmed cases in the past couple of days. And this is because Chinese authorities have increased the surveillance and testing for new coronavirus. So we have seen cases being confirmed in Beijing and Shenzhen, so outside original Wuhan area. We also have reported confirmed cases among travelers from China, confirmed by Thailand, South Korea, and Japan. So basically, we are now seeing more people being confirmed as countries increase the surveillance. That's a good sign. At the same time, we don't know many things about the virus yet, and this is something that we have to work on to try to understand the severity of the virus, the exact transmission mode, and what is the source of this new coronavirus.
It seems to have been a rapid spread recently, tripling, you know, since the last figures. Do we know what's behind this greater spread?
Well, this is basically really increased surveillance and testing. So more people you test, more cases you will find. This is a new virus from the family of coronaviruses. Coronaviruses normally circulate in the animal world, and then we'll jump to the human population, as it was the case with the SARS in 2002 or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome in 2012. We still don't know how easily it is being transmitted among humans. We know that there is a limited human-to-human transmission, but we don't know really is it easily spread and how exactly it is being transmitted. We don't know how severe it is. So far, there were three deaths, but we understand these were people with underlying health conditions. There were severe illness cases among infected people, but lots of reported cases have also been reported to be a mild cases. We don't know if there are asymptomatic cases yet. And then again, it would be important to know really what is the source. Coronaviruses are coming from animal world, but we should be able to determine exactly what that source is.
Now, you mentioned SARS from about 15, 20 years ago. What lessons have we learned from SARS that could be applied to controlling this new outbreak?
The critical thing is to have a strong health systems. Strong health systems that have equipped and trained health workforce, that have enough of core capacities that are built under international health regulations, basically being able to quickly detect, test, provide medical care to people who are infected, and basically put in place infection prevention and control measures at health facilities, having diagnostic tools, so all these things that make one health system strong. So that's why it was important, for example, this time that China, in just 9 days, was able to identify this new virus, to share its genetic sequence with WHO and with other countries, which ultimately helped other countries to test travelers. And again, being able really to reassure the population, to say what we know, what we don't know, and provide the general advice on how ordinary people can prevent exposure.
What are the basic precautions that people traveling to the region or people who have been to the region should be taking to avoid this virus?
Really, it is measures that we would recommend for avoiding any respiratory illness. This is basically covering your mouth when you are sneezing and coughing. Regular hand washing, so hand hygiene, avoiding contact with a sick person or person who we think could have a respiratory illness, avoiding contact with unprotected contact with the live animals at the market. And obviously, if you are sick and if you feel that you have a respiratory disease, to seek medical care as soon as possible. So then, hopefully, the health providers will be able to diagnose you quickly and to provide appropriate treatment.
Great. Thank you so much, Tariq. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
That was Tariq Jasarevich, spokesman for the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. A new Oxfam report says that the world's 2,153 billionaires have amassed more wealth than 4.6 billion people, up 60% of the planet's population. The report, titled Time to Care, says the inequality crisis continues to empower a wealthy elite as they accumulate vast fortunes at the expense of ordinary people, particularly poor women and girls. Max Lawson is head of policy on inequality at the British charity. VOA's Jackson Mvungani reached out to him in Nairobi and started off by asking him the basis of Oxfam's calculations for this report.
Oxfam's calculations are based on the Credit Suisse Global Wealth Report that gives you an estimate of the wealth of the world's population, and then the Forbes list of billionaires. So we compare the two, as we have done in previous years, and it shows an extreme level of inequality where you have this tiny group of people, just over 2,000 people, mostly men, mostly white, sitting on top of unimaginable amounts of money and having more wealth together than 60% of the world's population, which is about 4.6 billion people.
Now, part of the report says that the 22 richest men in the world have more wealth than all the women in Africa. What are the implications of this massive wealth gap?
Our main message this year is there is a connection between the extreme economic inequality, the gap between the super rich and the rest of us, and the gap between women and men, that this incredible wealth at the top of the global economy is built on the backs, on the work of hundreds of millions of women, women in Africa, women all over the world, working for free or working in poverty wages, poverty jobs, to support the global economy. And that all of the wealth they create in this sexist economy is being channeled upwards into the bank accounts, the secret bank accounts of the super rich.
Now, how did many of these billionaires acquire their wealth? Is this something that we know? Or generally speaking, what are the factors that led to this level of inequality? And can anything be done about it?
The problem of the super rich and the problem of the billionaires is a relatively new one. We've seen the number of billionaires double in the last 10 years. We've seen their wealth higher than it's ever been before. What that shows us is very recently, in recent times, we had much lower levels of inequality. We had much lower numbers of billionaires, which shows us that it's quite possible to have a vibrant and a successful global economy without this number of billionaires. And we would go further and say that, in fact, billionaires themselves are a sign of economic failure, not a sign of economic success. If we could instead take the wealth that's in their secret bank accounts and spread that around to redistribute, if we got them to pay their taxes as they should, just imagine the schools, the hospitals, the teachers, the nurses that that money could pay for. So we think that inequality is not inevitable. It's a policy choice. It's increased dramatically in recent years because governments have let it increase, and we think they could take steps to reduce the gap between rich and poor.
Now, this report was released ahead of the World Economic Forum that is due to take place in Davos in Switzerland. Can you explain to us the timing?
So the World Economic Forum is the biggest meeting of the super rich in the annual calendar and happens every January. So you've got well over 100 billionaires among many, many other multimillionaires, politicians, world leaders, going to this secretive mountain resort in Switzerland, where they like to think they can talk about solving the world's problems. So we use this moment to illustrate the scale of inequality in the world and to make the strong point that the solutions to the world's inequality crisis are never going to come from the people in Davos. These are the people who caused the problem in the first place. The solutions to the inequality crisis lie on the street. They lie with ordinary people protesting, fighting for a fairer world. And we're seeing that all over the world, from Chile to Lebanon to France, ordinary people demanding that their politicians listen to them instead of listening to billionaires.
Now, U.S. President Donald Trump is due to attend the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. What does his presence at this meeting mean?
President Trump is the billionaire's president. He's a billionaire himself, but not only that. Since he's been elected, he has rushed to implement policies that benefit his billionaire friends. Huge tax cuts for the super rich that see the richest Americans paying lower taxes than ordinary working class people. President Trump is a very clear example of the problem the world has with billionaires. The problem will be solved if we had a lot fewer billionaires with a lot less access to power, and we had a lot more ordinary people having their voices heard by governments around the world.
That was Max Lawson from Oxfam speaking to VOA's Jackson Mungani from Kenya, from Nairobi, Kenya. Among the top stories in the world, the extradition hearing for Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer for the Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei, begins Monday in Vancouver, Canada. American officials want Meng sent to the U.S. to face federal fraud charges. And as scientists warn that the Taal volcano in the Philippines could be, quote, recharging, unquote, for a more powerful explosion, Philippine authorities ordered a crackdown Monday on evacuees' daily visits to their homes in the danger zone. This is International Edition. Key players in the impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump and his defense argued sharply Sunday whether his efforts to get Ukraine to launch investigations to benefit him politically were impeachable offenses that warranted his removal from office. Trump's Senate trial formally opened last week and is set to hear opening arguments on Tuesday. To dive deeper into the Democrats' case against the president and the White House's 7-page response to the 2 articles of impeachment, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Joel Richard Paul, law professor at UC Hastings College of Law.
Well, the president's defense seems to come down to the assertion that the impeachment process itself is unconstitutional. And it appears that the principal objection they have is that the alleged offense by the president either did not occur, and they have not yet produced any exculpatory evidence to show that, or that even if it had occurred, that it was not an impeachable offense. And this really comes down to the question, does it have to be a criminal act in order for it to be impeachable? Our impeachment process comes to us through the British. We've had a long tradition in Anglo-American law of impeachments going back to 1376. And from the very beginning, it was understood in the British Parliament that impeachment was a device used to remove people for abuse of power, not necessarily for criminal action.
If we take a look at the trial itself taking place in the Senate last week, Chief Justice Roberts swore in the senators who said that they would be impartial and uphold their oath to the Constitution. But at the same time, looking at the Sunday talk shows, looking at media sound bites, both Democrats and Republicans are making the case in the court of public opinion. How crucial is it that despite what is being said on the public airwaves and the cable airwaves in the media, that the trial be fair and impartial?
I think that's a really important question, Steve. I think that it's inappropriate for both Democrats and Republicans who are in the Senate to opine now about the trial when we have not seen all the evidence. It is still possible that the president's attorneys may produce some exculpatory evidence that would be decisive in the trial. It's also possible that there more evidence is coming out every day and that may be conclusive. I don't think that anyone should prejudge the trial, even though they may have certain political loyalties here. This is not about tribalism. It's not about one tribe against another tribe. It's a very serious question that is relevant to the integrity of our elections and the security and independence of our country.
That was Professor Joel Richard Paul from the UC Hastings College of Law speaking to Steve Miller from his home in California. Monday is Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the United States. It's a day set aside to remember the famed civil rights leader and anti-war activist and the values of nonviolence, justice, and racial equality that he and millions of other Americans fought for. But often overlooked is King's experience in Africa, which was decolonizing in the late 1950s and 1960s. Julius Amin is a Cameroon-born professor of history at the University of Dayton in Dayton, Ohio. He says the freedom struggle in America and Africa were entwined in Dr. King's view. Amin told VOA's Adam Phillips that King's active relationship with African activists began in Ghana.
King went to Africa in 1957 for the first time. He was invited to Ghana by Kwame Nkrumah to participate in the independence celebration of Ghana. And he was amazed in terms of how powerful peaceful resistance, nonviolent action was. And King saw very clearly the connection between African people and African Americans, that the struggle by African Americans against freedom in America and the struggle against colonialism were both sides of the same coin. They all apply to the contempt for the black person, the contempt for blackness, the contempt for black community, the contempt for black society, the contempt for what black people stood for. This was integral to colonialism, and this was integral to American racism.
Tell me a little bit more about Nkrumah's achievements and how they overlapped with King's struggle.
Ghana was the first nation in sub-Saharan Africa to gain independence, and it was largely as a result of the work of Kwame Nkrumah. In fact, Nkrumah started in the United States. Nkrumah was a victim of American racism, and when he returned to Ghana, he began to organize peaceful marches, peaceful demonstrations, telling people, do not buy products from European nations, which eventually forced the British to grant independence to Ghana. And that's what really moved King, because there were people in America who were very critical of his nonviolent tactics. And so when he went to Ghana, in fact, after he returned, King stated that anyone who is critical of nonviolence should see the example of Ghana.
Of course, the early 1960s was a time of great idealism in America, just in terms of policy. For example, President Kennedy started the U.S. Peace Corps, which started many American young people on the road to activism.
In fact, American Peace Corps volunteers who went to Africa to teach. These are white volunteers. They were being asked questions. Why would you discriminate against blacks in America and then choose to come serve in all black countries? Do you have black friends in America? So this message of the struggle for rights by African Americans and the struggle for freedom by African nationalists really was important to both groups.
Could you tell me a bit more about how America's civil rights struggle affected African activists at the time?
The civil rights movement influenced the struggles in Africa tremendously. The whole sense of the Black Consciousness Movement, the Black Power Movement, the students, the Freedom Rights students, empower students in Africa in tremendous ways. James Brown was singing, "I'm Black, I'm Proud," and this message was contagious. Everywhere in Africa, people were singing, "I'm Black, I'm Proud." And African nationalists became empowered by this message as they continue with the struggle. And King, when he gave that I Have a Dream speech, there was a sense of urgency in terms of fairness, in terms of justice, in terms of equality, in terms of human rights. And King's message is urgently needed right now as we speak. For example, King's message is urgently needed now in Cameroon. There is a constant struggle for human rights. Look at the Gambia, equity, the sense of social concern, the sense of social justice. These are issues that King stood for. And these are the things that many African nations need today. It's important to just move beyond the labels and apply King's message to create a beloved community.
That was Julius Amin, professor of history at the University of Dayton in Dayton, Ohio, speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Britain's Prince Harry voiced, quote, great sadness, end quote, at bowing out entirely from representing the British monarchy under the agreements he had reached with his grandmother, Queen Elizabeth, and other senior members of the royal family.
The decision that I have made for my wife and I to step back is not one I made lightly. It was so many months of talks after so many years of challenges. And I know I haven't always gotten it right, but as far as this goes, there really was no other option.
His emotional remarks late Sunday were his first on the crisis that has shaken Britain's monarchy. The prince and his wife Meghan, an American former actress, have struggled under intense media scrutiny since their wedding in May 2018. The prince said stepping back from royal duties was important to build, quote, a more peaceful life, end quote, with their baby son Archie. But he said his loyalty to his homeland remains.
The UK is my home and a place that I love. That will never change. I've grown up feeling supported from so many of you, and I watched as you welcomed Meghan with open arms, as you saw me find the love and happiness that I'd hoped for all my life.
The couple plan to live part of the time in Canada. Aboriginal leaders say Australia's bushfire crisis has prompted, quote, huge interest, end quote, from farmers, landowners, and homeowners wanting to learn more about Indigenous burning techniques. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The bushfire crisis in Australia has prompted questions about how the world's driest inhabited continent can fight future blazes in a warmer and still drier climate. Indigenous leaders say that cultural burning techniques can help the country become more resilient to wildfires. A cultural burn can also rejuvenate flora, protect native animal habitat, and strengthen spiritual ties to the land. Practitioners say Indigenous fire plans, different from other widely used hazard reduction burns, would help to prevent a repeat of this summer's devastating blazes in Australia. Aboriginal methods involve the lighting of frequent small so-called cool fires in specific areas during the early dry season between March and July. The flames burn slowly, reducing vegetation that can feed wildfires. They also create fire breaks. Victor Stephenson, an Indigenous fire expert, says the strategy can make the land more resilient.
Activation of country is exactly what Indigenous burning is. It's activating the landscape to look after the biodiversity and to stop the country burning to nothing.
The urgency is past. There's animals that are already extinct. Elders have already passed. Knowledge already gone to the grave. There's devastating fires around the world. There's sicknesses within the landscapes. What more can I say? We're past our due date, but I believe that there's still time.
Heavy rain has fallen across much of southeastern Australia. For the first time in weeks, fewer than 100 bushfires are burning in the states of New South Wales and Victoria. But officials warn the danger isn't over, with more hot and windy weather expected later this week. 30 people have died in the fires since September. More than 2,000 homes have been destroyed, and an area of land almost the size of England has been scorched. The disaster has been made worse by record temperatures, a long drought, and climate change. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening.